Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, and welcome to Inside Scoop Live. Thanks for tuning in. I'm your host, Juanita Watson, and today I'll be talking with author Larry Hayes. Larry's new book, Mental Illness and Your Town, 37 Ways for Communities to Help and Heal, has just been released on Loving Healing Press and is a very compassionate look at taking mental illness out of the shadows and into the community. A Pulitzer finalist and champion of the underdog, Larry Hayes wrote editorials and columns for the Fort Wayne Journal Gazette for more than a quarter century. Among his many accomplishments, Larry launched a winning crusade to gain the transfer of a 14-year-old girl from an adult prison to juvenile treatment. He got a university to create one of the country's first institutes for behavior studies. He helped found a suicide prevention council. He introduced crisis training to his city for police dealing with the mentally ill, and he campaigned for the creation of a rehabilitation center for people with major mental illness. His much-praised memoir, Monday I'll Save the World, recounts his battles for rational gun regulation, an end to corporal punishment in schools, abolition of the death penalty, and a ban on smoking in restaurants. U.S. Senator Dick Lugar says that Larry's writing has changed lives. Larry holds degrees in theology and English. He is married with two children and two grandchildren. In 2000, he retired to write books and continue his advocacy, now focused on winning better services for people with mental illness. And you can find out more about Larry at communitymentalhealth.us. So with that being said, welcome to the program, Larry.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Yeah, well, congratulations on your new book. This is quite a project.
Thank you. Really, it's the accumulation of years and years of interviewing people and going through a lot of experiences with mental illness in our own family. I was treated for depression in a hospital and given shock treatments when I was in my 30s, I guess. And then when my son was in his teenage years, he developed a mental illness. And then after I joined the paper in 1972, I did a lot of advocacy on behalf of people with a mental illness and wrote a number of things based on the research that I did, interviewing experts from around the country. I attended conferences. And so the book reflects a lot of years of experience, personal experience in the family, and also a lot of research
throughout that time.
Yes.
Well, I was wondering if your study into mental illness had gone back that far, if you had picked it up at some later point in life, but it sounds like you've been on this for a long time. And I wanted to kind of find out from you how you became this champion for the underdog. And it seems like that was its roots right there.
Yes. Well, actually, when I was a seminary student, I had classes and did some research as a graduate student into mental illness. So it even predates my own experience with depression and my hospitalization.
Now, you mentioned shock treatments. We don't do those kinds of techniques anymore, do we?
Oh, yes. ECT, electroconvulsive therapy, is rather quite common. It's used throughout the country. It's given to people for whom traditional or more ordinary treatments do not seem to be effective.
Mm.
The therapy has changed a lot over the years. It's a lot milder. Mainly the side effect would be loss of short-term memory, but that in most all cases returns to people.
I thought that it was just at this point more medication that was being issued. I didn't know that we still did some of those harsher techniques.
Well, I'm not sure it's harsher. The medications can have pretty severe side effects, too.
Yes,
but,
of course.
You're right. The medications are the most common. However, if somebody has a fairly mild or moderate kind of depression, and we're talking about unipolar depression, not the swings of mood back and forth in manic depression or bipolar disorder, that person probably does as well with a lot of vigorous exercise, a lot of other kinds of activity, volunteer work and that sort of thing, can be just as effective or more effective than the medication alone. And in more severe cases, in fact, the therapy and the medication seems to be more effective than medication in and of itself.
Mm-hmm. We're at this point with prescription medication, and it's very much a pop a pill culture right now. And I was wondering if you think that the widespread prescribing of medication for mental illness may be a part of the problem, in that it doesn't focus on everything that someone may need to heal. And it sounds like that's what you're saying. People need exercise. They need other outlets.
Right, right. But often people are just too depressed to get up and go. It's very debilitating. One forgets that serious depression, a clinical depression, really takes a toll on a person's physical well-being as well as their mental health.
What was it like for you having to deal with that with yourself and then with your son? I mean, this is your family, really.
That's certainly the case. When I interviewed Rabbi Kushner, who lost a son to a very rare aging disease when the child was 13, Rabbi Kushner told me that as hard as it is to lose a child, he thought it was even more difficult to have a son or daughter with a major mental illness. And I said, well, why is that? And he said, because eventually with the death you have closure, but there is no closure with mental illness, and certainly that's the case with the most severe kinds of mental illness, where there's depression and a manic phase, as in bipolar disorder,
mm-hmm.
and certainly with schizophrenia. Those, in most all cases, tend to be chronic. That is, you always have them, and they appear to be lifelong. Those illnesses have a tremendous impact on the family. Because, you grieve over this loss of your son or daughter's potential, because you always imagine that they're going to grow up and go to college and be the outstanding football player or something rather like that. And instead, here they're basically stuck, and they need a lot of emotional support that can be very draining on families. And the other thing is families usually don't know where to go. You know, it's usually a first generation experience with the mental health system, the system of which has changed through the years, so people start with the family doctor, who often may misdiagnose the person or prescribe the wrong medication. So the family struggles to find out exactly what the resources are in their own community, and then you may not get the right psychiatrist or the right therapist or the right family doctor dealing with this this thing that is so mysterious. A person with a mental illness can seem quite normal and functional one day, and the next day they can't get out of bed.
Yes.
Or they're hearing voices, or how do you deal with that? And there's a long term impact too, because you're not only feeling that there's been this tremendous loss, and you're struggling to find resources to help the child, you end up with some expenses that you hadn't anticipated.
Mm-hmm.
Often this is people who are about to retire, and they're trying to husband away a certain amount of money to take care of themselves in their retirement, and then they're also trying to deal with an adult child who can't afford gas for his or her car, or if they don't have a car, bus money, food, sometimes Medicaid, the public financial assistance for people with this kind of disability is cut off, or it doesn't come through quickly enough. So there are financial complications and responsibilities, burdens. There are emotional burdens. So it does affect the family, and it's something often that's unrecognized, the long grieving process that a family goes through.
I imagine that a lot of families suffer in silence.
Oh, they do. Mm-hmm. They do. And mm-hmm. denial. And that's why I say I want to bring mental illness out of the shadows so people don't feel ashamed. The person who develops a mental illness goes through a period, and it may be just a feature of the illness for as long as they exhibit the symptoms. They may just feel too ashamed to do anything about it. And a lot of people do suffer themselves in silence, and the family, even if the person, the family member who is sick is getting treatment, the family may be in a state of denial and even in some cases be estranged from the person with the disability.
Mm-hmm. Just can't accept the behavior, so they stay in that state of denial. Do you have any statistics regarding how prevalent mental illness is in our country? And when you're talking mental illness, it sounds to me like this is encompassing a lot of different things, from mild depression to schizophrenia, like you said.
Right.
Does it include PTSD?
There's anxiety disorder.
Okay.
There are a variety of things, someplace between depression and schizophrenia. There's schizoid tipple. There are different manifestations of schizophrenia, too. Some people with schizophrenia are quite paranoid. The incidence of mental illness, it's rather much more common than I think most people would suggest. Schizophrenia, as I said, it's the most severe form, most debilitating, most disabling. That is about 1% of the population, 1 in 100.
Mm-hmm.
Really? Bipolar disorder, about 2 persons out of 100. But then you have estimates from the National Alliance on Mental Illness, which is a large 250,000 strong family support group. They estimate that 1 family in 5 has a family member with a mental illness.
Wow.
But extrapolate that to people in the neighborhood, and then to businesses, schools. No matter what kind of institution you're in, we're going to be dealing with people with a mental illness. And the training, which I stress a lot in my new book, the training is very inadequate, if it exists at all, in all of these institutions. But where there is good training, as there has been in the U.S. Air Force, then the incidence of suicide go down, and suicide is kind of a indirect marker of the incidence of mental illness. But what they did with the Air Force was they trained managers in recognizing mental illness, mental disorders in service men and women, and got them into counseling. But that's not universal, I don't believe, yet in the services. And of course we've seen stories, they're very tragic stories, of servicemen and women coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan having lots of mental health issues
with PTSD
and, high incidence of suicide.
Mm-hmm.
And homicide.
So mental illness, then, is it necessarily inherited? It's something that situations can actually bring up and cause a mental illness? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, the current science is that there is a propensity genetically in in some families for a person to develop a mental illness, but that in turn would need to be triggered by the person's environmental experiences. There are also there's some research that physical and psychological abuse of a child can later erupt in mental illness. There's some evidence that the mothers, if a mother develops certain kinds of flu symptoms, she may have a child who is more likely to develop a mental illness.
Oh, really?
That's a fairly recent study that was reported in a regular article in Scientific American this past year.
There's still so much that we have to learn about it.
Yeah, that's right. And even if the state of the science right now and the art and treatment goes no farther, you still have just untold numbers of people who get no treatment, or they medicate themselves with alcohol or drugs, prescription drugs or illegal drugs. We've got a large population of people who aren't getting help, and therefore they're not functioning. But I want to emphasize that when people do get treatment, they often are able to go back to work.
Mm-hmm.
Often they're able to be very successful. I personally know people who function as medical professionals. And then I've met and interviewed Mike Wallace, who told me that his family doctor told him, "Come on, Mike, you're tough. You can get over your depression." And he didn't until he'd been on one of the antidepressants for a couple of months, and he was in Lebanon interviewing people in a civil war. But that's one of the common myths, that anybody can, if they just tried hard enough, they could get over it. And as my son, who has become a very effective advocate on behalf of people with mental illness, would tell you, that it's not just the general public who don't have a mental illness who buy into the stigma and the myth. It's the person himself or herself, the person with the disability. They believe, A, this is my fault. B, I should be able to get over it by just thinking better thoughts, by trying harder, by being active. Sometimes those things help, but the main thing is to get professional help and to train people who are in a position of authority over others, or a position of responsibility, to become knowledgeable not only about what the illness is and the possible causes, but also how to interact with folks who have a mental illness. And this is just a huge challenge, and I think it's one that is something that I need to find a lot of other people signing on to the cause.
Mm-hmm.
It's really important, and it just affects so many people and so many families. And I always say, nobody deserves this, no matter what the cause is, and they certainly don't deserve to suffer alone.
Right. Right. There seems to be just so much shame that is in and around mental illness, and it really is unnecessary. So really, I think that bringing mental illness out of the shadows, like you say, and this is really the main objective of your book, I believe, is to just educate people and be an advocate and give ideas for where the community can help. So why don't we talk a little to that?
Well, the advocacy is just a huge challenge, but often people don't know where to start.
Mm-hmm.
One good place to start, of course, I'm an old editorial page editor, retired, and so I like to see people write letters to the editor. There are ways of writing effective letters to the editor. I give workshops, and I've written a little bit about this for folks. And anybody who wants to learn more about writing effective letters and other things for the newspaper can read the book, or they can contact me through the website. The other thing that people really need to appreciate is that the most effective thing that they have going for themselves isn't the statistics. It's not the theories and the science on the causes of mental illness. It's their own personal stories. Those are the things that really move policymakers to change the formulas that allow people to live independently, so they're not struggling, or they don't become just a horrendous burden on their families. Those are the kinds of things that really can make a difference. But you need to get out of the shadows yourself if you're going to have any impact on public policy and any impact, say, on a school. You need to talk to the people who are making the decisions, people in a position to invite, say, representatives of NAMI or Mental Health America in to talk about mental illness. So those are things that people can do. My son, for example, gives talks to nurses and people in psychology classes, and he basically tells his own story and adds some things that they can do so that people really are able to make a connection with this disability and not see it just as some statistics or some science about the causes of mental illness, the brain chemistry, and so on, and all that. I'm not saying it's not important, but the thing that really hits people in the gut and tugs at their heartstrings and gets them to envision a different way of functioning and a different way of handling this disability, that's through the personal stories.
So it's almost like a re-education through personal stories, and with the statistics that you basically have told us, really every one of us will somehow be touched either directly or indirectly with mental illness.
That's true. You'll have coworkers, and mm-hmm. we had them when I was at the paper. We had one coworker, an excellent reporter who developed his clinical depression. And the management, she did not write for me, but she worked in another department. They were rather uninformed or not terribly sensitive about how to deal with her, and probably exacerbated her difficulty and her recovery. Eventually, she did recover. Fortunately, she was not fired. Although that does happen, even though it may be against the law as presented in the Americans for Disability Act.
Mm-hmm. So what are some of the new programs, Larry, that are being utilized today for treatment?
Well, the one that seems to have had such an impact on the life of my son is the Carriage House, which follows the clubhouse model. It started in New York City by some former mental hospital patients. The program in New York City is called Fountain House, covers a huge city block, West 47. But there are over 300 of these programs. They're non-traditional, that is, they do not emphasize the medical side of the treatment, but they emphasize what they call the work order day. There are activities at these clubhouses for everyone to do to contribute to the ongoing success of the clubhouse, serving meals, contacting people who haven't been at the clubhouse recently, and also helping people find part-time jobs. They're called transitional employment jobs. The clubhouse model and the research on that shows that it is very successful at reintegrating people into the community and into society and helping them become the productive citizens that everybody really wants to be. So that is one of the most successful programs. Another program is called the ACT program, or PACT, P-A-C-T or A-C-T, that was developed originally in Madison, Wisconsin. That is an intensive case management program. So you've got a group of people who are assigned to your situation, and they help you handle all kinds of things, from your finances to finding a job, staying in a job, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
But those are two examples of things that seem to be very helpful.
And what a lessening of the burden for the family to take their family member through that process. I mean, it seems like that is a very important bridge to get people that are suffering from that disability into the community.
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, that's true. The unfortunate thing is here we have a community, or larger metropolitan area is about 300,000 or so, and we have 60 people who come to our clubhouse. It's called the Carriage House. Every day on average, 50, 60 people. Well, you can do the math. It's just a small percentage of those folks who could benefit from this kind of program.
Mm-hmm.
And we're always doing outreach. We do fundraising. We had a big program recently, Dancing with the Fort Wayne Stars.
Oh.
Raised, it raised over $100,000 for our program. But and we reached maybe 700-800 people, so we have more people who know about our program, but it's still reaching a tiny percentage of those who undoubtedly would benefit and whose lives could be changed.
So there's still quite a ways to go.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
It seems like rehabilitation models like that, and what you're saying with basically getting this information out into the public, it seems to me like it's not only going to heal the person with the illness, but it's also, you're in a process of helping to heal the community and the misconceptions and really the fear that still is so prevalent out there.
Well, these national organizations do a lot of advocacy, and a lot of it is addressed to the stigma
mm-hmm.
of mental illness.
Mm-hmm.
It is just a huge undertaking. I don't know if you can ever erase it. It's hard to understand mental illness. You know, you wonder, well, why doesn't he just go get a job? Why,
right.
What's wrong with her? Why doesn't she just take care of her kids? Or why doesn't she take some antidepressant? And by the way, as we were talking before about antidepressants, there are some people, Dr. Graydon at the Depression Center at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor has a book out, and it's about the treatment, the research and the treatment on people who have depression, but their disability is very resistant to treatment. You can get people through antidepressants and all kinds of activities, and they're still depressed. They get shock treatments, they're still depressed, on and on, a lifetime. I have a former a classmate of mine from undergraduate school who was a missionary. They may still be in Chile, and she suffered depression all of her adult life, or has. And so it's hard to understand, and it is hard to accept. And then on top of that, you have these horrific crimes that are committed by people who are not under treatment or not under appropriate
mm-hmm.
treatment
yeah.
for mental illness. And it's, they're hearing voices. God is telling them to kill their child or push this man off of or this young woman off of the platform at the subway. And those stories get into on the front pages. You have lurid accounts of this sort of thing, and then they get into court, and you have the back and forth accounts and interpretations, diagnoses by different specialists. The prosecution will get a specialist, a psychiatrist, to testify that the man isn't crazy. The defense attorney will have two psychiatrists who will testify that the man is very much mentally ill and not responsible for what he's done.
Mm-hmm.
So those kind of stories, even after the horrific crime, kind of reinforce this idea that mentally ill people are dangerous, or that they try to make excuses for their mistakes or for their evil doing.
Mm-hmm. That's a really good point.
And we'll be back with more Inside Scoop Live after these important announcements.
Hi there. Are you looking for new ways to promote your book? Why not consider being interviewed live? With the huge impact internet radio as well as podcasting is making in our society, your voice can now be heard worldwide. Let Juanita at Inside Scoop Live create the necessary steps for you. You will not only receive a web page of your own, but your interview will be available for MP3 download and RSS feed. As well, your interview will be posted on venues such as iTunes, Blog Talk Radio, Podcast Alley, and the Inside Scoop Live blog. Go to InsideScoopLive.com today for more information. Welcome back to Inside Scoop Live. Just to remind you, I'm talking today with Larry Hayes, author of Mental Illness and Your Town. You can find out more about Larry through his website, communitymentalhealth.us. So do you think then that there will need to be some reform with the criminal justice system?
Yes, you know, we've started looking at that for misdemeanors, the lower form of crime that doesn't hurt a lot of people. We have around the country started, and the federal government supports these courts. They're called mental health courts, and they divert people from jail or from different kinds of punishment and get them into treatment. Sometimes they're pretty strict. My knowledge of them is that they really haven't caught on. In fact, some advocates for people with mental illness and some people with a disability don't like the mental health courts because they are pretty coercive, and they involve the person, the offender, being policed,
mm-hmm.
sort of in this rehabilitation process,
mm-hmm.
Whereas if they had just been incarcerated and gone through the regular system, if it's assuming it's a misdemeanor, they'd be locked up for a few days and then they'd be finished with it.
Mm-hmm.
So, and the other thing is going through a mental health court may carry a certain stigma to it. I don't have any strong feeling about it, but I think anything that we can do to help divert people from prison, in itself can make a person crazy.
Sure. That's not a rehabilitation center.
No, it is not, which is another area. Our jail personnel and our prison personnel are not trained well in mental illness, much less in dealing with people, and the punishments tend to be extremely severe and counterproductive, in fact.
I imagine that it's a high percentage of people that are in our prison system right now that are suffering from some form of mental illness,
right,
whether it be
right.
mild to severe.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I've said for years, you know, if you're not crazy when you go in,
it'll make you crazy.
You know, and it is an extremely stressful environment.
Yeah.
I've interviewed people who've been in the system. I've been at prisons and interviewed people who are incarcerated. It doesn't always serve society. I think my own view is that there is a small percentage of people that you can't do anything with. They're just too dangerous to be out in a community.
Mm-hmm.
But that is not the majority of people who are locked up, this country, as you probably know, locks up more people than just about any other country per capita.
Yeah, that's
a lot of those, as you suggest, a lot of those folks do have a serious mental illness, and the treatments, even where the mental illness is recognized in the prison, the treatment is kind of hit and miss. I know that the therapy, the visits with a therapist, for example, maybe once every couple of weeks, whereas if the person were out in the community, they might be seeing a therapist a couple of times a week.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, what do you do in prison? You get one therapist, and if you and the guy don't click,
no luck.
You're out of luck.
And I imagine in a prison, too, you're not being exposed to a huge world around you. It's a very controlled environment, so you may not have...
And these other people who are your role models, or, they're...
Right.
For a kid, for example, this one kid that I did a lot of advocacy for, she was 14 when she was sent to an adult prison.
Mm-hmm.
And her role models were... some of the worst people in Indiana.
That didn't
really make a lot of sense. And finally, we got that changed, and she ended up spending the bulk of her teen years in a juvenile treatment center.
Great. So speaking to the whole idea of stress triggering mental illness, you know, we're living in a time right now that is incredibly stressful, and it's getting more stressful for a lot of people. What are your thoughts on how, you know, in the future, coming year, 2, 3 years, that we may actually see mental illness really spike because of all of what's happening right now economically, this sort of thing?
Well, it's certainly putting a strain in many ways on families, and the families may find a great deal of anxiety. They may feel the need to see a doctor and to go into therapy, and I think that's certainly appropriate. In good times, most of us just sort of muddle through. It takes you a lifetime to figure out how to function as a mature, rational person, and then it seems your life is about over. And then you add all these stresses, and you can imagine people who have a propensity for mental illness anyway, Their depression, for example, comes and goes, like this former classmate that I mentioned. That extra stress is certainly likely to bring out the most severe kinds of mental illness. It can be in anxiety as well as in depression.
Mm-hmm.
And again, the medications don't always help. Sometimes they are a lifesaver. But sometimes they don't help. My son, for example, was on 17 different medications.
Oh, wow.
During his adult life, and I've teased psychiatrist friends of mine. I said, "You guys really don't know what you're doing." I said, "Well, you have to try and see what really is going to work." And of course, the brain chemistry, which we're learning more and more about, does change. There's a fairly new concept called the plasticity of the brain, and there are certain kinds of therapy that seem to help somebody overcome a mental illness. Very small studies so far, but that relates to how somebody responds to stress. But in turn, while you have all this additional stress on the individual, the breadwinner who's now out of a job at the factory, the mom has to go to work, new stress is on the kids, who's supervising the homework. That is being multiplied thousands and thousands of times over in the country right now as the unemployment level spikes. And not to mention retirees who are seeing their savings just disappear overnight, practically. Anyway, that puts stress on the family doctor's schedule. He's got more people coming, so you got more people out in the waiting room. Then you have, in turn, he refers somebody to the psychiatrist. And psychiatry is one of the lowest paying of the medical specialties.
Mm-hmm.
So there's always a shortage
mm-hmm.
in cities
mm-hmm.
of psychiatrists. And some of them, I think all the psychiatrists would acknowledge, some of the psychiatrists aren't very good. So you add stress to that, to the community mental health center, like our Park Center here. And in the meantime, state funds are down because people are out of work. They're not paying state taxes, or they're not buying as much to spend with their dwindling income. The sales tax dwindles. Fortunately, our state has a surplus, but it's certainly not going to be spent on mental health services, even though those services are in greater demand. So this is really a time of great, great challenge for the mental health system.
Mm-hmm.
All the more reason to get this subject out of the shadows, and let's talk about it. Let's get it on the front page. Let's tell these stories and feature stories in the newspapers and on the news reports and in interviews.
Mm-hmm. What are some of the things that individuals can do today? You know, you had mentioned start writing their stories. What else can we do?
Well, you can go to public meetings and ask to be on the agenda. You can go to school board meetings and say, I'd like to speak. You, I'm sure, have to put your request in writing. No matter how large the school board is, how large the school district is, they're bound to have some provision for allowing the public to get up and speak. And you just get up and say, you know, I'm concerned about what the mental health services are in the school district and what the training is of teachers. And I can tell you, teachers don't get much of any training in mental illness. It's going to all
mm-hmm.
be kind of happenstance in some cases. Of course, it's going to be learning about mental illness the hard way by having it yourself or having it in the family.
Yes.
But those are things that go to public meetings, ask to speak, and meet with your public officials privately, call up their offices, send or get a delegation together, go meet with the mayor. What are we doing? One of the things I tell people in workshops when I do a workshop is don't go and tell people what you want them to do.
mm-hmm.
You've given them two choices, no or yes, but they're very unlikely to say yes. So the other choice is they'll say, no, I can't do that, or that's for somebody else, or they'll say, I'll think about it, which is the same thing as saying no.
Mm-hmm.
So what you want to do in your role as a lobbyist on behalf of mental health and persons who suffer from mental illness, what you want to do is to enlist them in your concern. So you tell them your story and you ask them, what can we do? And that's how you pulled them into the whole cause. What can we do? What can you help me do?
Mm.
And then they begin to have a sense of buy-in. And if there's a whole room full of people sitting there with tears running down their cheeks,
yeah.
They may say, oh, maybe there's something that the legislature has to do here. And I'll ask my aide, say you're talking to the governor, have my aide look into what we're doing. Let's have a meeting with the head of the Division of Mental Health or whatever, you know. But you really need to find out as much as you can about who makes the decisions. So as far as supporting your local mental health center, then we're talking about state government.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody has legislators in your neighborhood, and you ask for a meeting, find out when they're available, talk to them on the phone. Tell them your story, though. As I said earlier, Those things are so powerful.
Mm-hmm. Carefully consider your approach with them, though.
I'm sorry?
And carefully consider your approach, it sounds like. You know, just don't have a strong agenda before you walk in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. Your agenda is to enlist an ally.
Mm-hmm.
And don't forget, if you're talking about aid for a mental health disability, that kind of support is also going to have to come, or it likely will come, for people with other kinds of disability, paraplegics,
mm-hmm.
people with hearing or other kinds of sight, other kinds of disabilities. So then you need to collaborate with other agencies. Hey, what are you doing over there at the League for the Blind? What are you doing at the Anthony Wayne Services that serves people with developmental disability? So you reach out to other types of agencies that represent other kinds of disabilities to see whether there are some ways that you can work together. The more people involved, of course, the bigger the impact you'll have on policymakers, who, after all, are elected.
Mm-hmm. Now, is there any other arenas that we haven't touched on that could be possible places for advocacy? I mean, just one coming to mind would be the clergy, and I know you do talk about that in your book.
Yes. I have a chapter in this book on clergy. We, in Fort Wayne, our local affiliate of NAMI, National Alliance on Mental Illness, has presented conferences for clergy, educating clergy about mental illness. And I have brought together a group of people in my congregation who are professional mental health professionals, and formed a mental health committee. We have brochures. We help people make connections. We don't do any direct services, but we help people make connections in the community with other services that would be appropriate for them. And I also give talks on this kind of thing to various groups of religious people or advocates for peace and justice. I've talked to such groups over the years a great deal about mental illness and becoming educated about mental illness and not stigmatizing it or opposing the stigmatization of mental illness.
Mm-hmm. Now, I've heard you also talk that there is a depression center, a University of Michigan depression center.
Yes, that's the first one in the country. There's another one in Denver that has just started in the last year or so.
What are they doing?
They do research.
Mm-hmm.
They have day therapy. It's a huge center. It is extremely impressive, and it's called a depression center. And that in itself is the way the director, Dr. John Graydon, has attempted to combat the stigma. So just like we have cancer centers around the country, whereas treatment of cancer used to be kind of hush-hush, there was a stigma with that. Now that's out of the shadows, and his attempt is to get depression and the treatment of these mood disorders, these mental illnesses, out of the shadows too, just by saying what we're talking about.
Mm.
We're talking about depression. We're not just talking about, well, you're having trouble sleeping, you can't get out of bed. You know, we're talking about depression.
Mm.
They do treatment, day treatment there. Of course, they draw on the resources of the University of Michigan's medical staffs at the hospital and so on, and have huge staff available. They're therapists, and it's a bright, engaging place. I've been there, visited, spent a half a day with Dr. Graydon and one of his associates, and they launch research projects. They have collected the DNA of people and family members who suffer from depression or bipolar disorder. So that is one of the most hopeful things. Incidentally, Mike Wallace, I believe, is on the board, the advisory board of the University of Michigan's Depression Center.
Well, that's fantastic. So do they do rehabilitation at that center, or is it more research?
Both. When you have day therapy, that is the rehabilitation.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
They also have a program at Flint where they're helping train the staffs of family doctors to deal more effectively with depression. You know, most people who have a mental illness are going to get their initial treatment from a family doctor.
Mm-hmm.
And it's imperative that family doctors are better educated than they have been in the past. Dr. Graydon told me that family doctors typically miss about half of the diagnoses.
Wow.
And when they get the diagnoses correct, the treatment is not appropriate.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen that research before. I'm sure many family doctors would say, yes, we really know we're behind the curve on this one. The problem with family doctors is that they are so busy, and the treatment of mental illness requires a lot of time, a lot of follow-up work, the person needs to be monitored on medication. After the suicide of Vince Foster, who was a White House attorney under the Clinton administration, I interviewed the head of the National Institute of Mental Health, Dr. Fred Goodwin, who was an international authority on depression and bipolar, and he mentioned to me that